I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. For this episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo about his new novel, Under the Falls, which is a bit of a departure for Russo because it's a thriller. If you are a fan of Russo's for the book that earned him the prize, Empire Falls, or perhaps for his Fool series, don't discount a Russo thriller. Here's our conversation. So there are many elements in Under the Falls that I would consider spoilers. So I'd like to start by asking you to give a brief description of the book. How would you set it up for our listeners?
Well, I would set it up kind of in the way that I did in the novel. And this is kind of an interesting story. Before I turned the characters loose, that is Tyler and his band, before they land in Albany and get into that limo and head up Stone Mountain to the gig that he's going to be performing there, what I did was to introduce the place first. There is a short intro at the beginning that talks a little bit about the Adirondacks in general. And what happens if you head up the Northway, for instance, on your way to Montreal? And if you head up that way, you start running into the kinds of communities that I, growing up in a left behind place called Gloversville, New York, if you start heading up that way, you discover the kinds of towns that people like me, or, you know, just folks from kind of left behind places, you suddenly discover you're getting into pretty ritzy territory up there. I mean, the first one that you encounter is Saratoga Springs. And then after that, you know, you hit Lake Placid and other towns that normal people in upstate New York cannot afford to live in. And you have this notion that wealth has something to do with altitude. You know, just keep going north and heading up in terms of altitude. And there are these really, really ritzy places. But that's not always true. And that's what I did in this book, is to suggest you go up another route into the Adirondacks. I think it's Route 29, which was what I and my friends used to do back when I was 18 years old. In the summers, we would drive up to this place called Caroga Lake. I fictionalized that and called it Stone Mountain. Drinking age was 18 then. And we would drive up there, Caroga Lake, and close the bars and come screaming down that mountain. And why I'm here talking to you right now, I don't know. Because so many times we could have gone off that path down from Caroga Lake, right where Tyler's limo leaves the road, right? So anyway, when I told my editor I was writing a thriller, which was new, and I started it, it didn't have that introduction of the place first. And I have one of the best editors in the business, Jordan Pavlin at Knopf. And she said, I want you to go back and reread the beginning of all three of your Fool novels. You know, Nobody's Fool, Everybody's Fool, Somebody's Fool. And I want you to begin this book like you began those books. She said, because what you're doing by putting Tyler in that limo and heading him towards Stone Mountain without letting us loose there first before he gets there, she said, what you're doing is bending your knee to the thriller. And she said, I want you to bend the thriller's knee to you. Make this a Richard Russo novel. To the extent that it's still a thriller, fine, I don't care. But write it the way you've written all of your other books. And it was such wonderful advice, because it was advice I could use not just at the beginning, but all the way through the book. Don't try to make it a thriller. Try to make it the kind of book that when my readers read the book, they recognize the territory that they're in. So that's what I did.
It's almost like you introduced us to another character first, this personification of Stone Mountain. And Stone Mountain has many meanings in the book. You know, it's the town in the Adirondacks. It's the name of the lake. It's the name of an old local amusement park. It's also the name of a band. And the band leader is Tyler, who you were talking about. So what is going on here? Why did Tyler name his band after the place where he grew up?
Yeah, I mean, Tyler does not leave Stone Mountain in the best of circumstances. He is 18 years old, and the first band that he ever created he created up there on Stone Mountain, and he called it Stone Mountain. And they were already, by the time he was 18, they were already pretty good. They were probably the best band, not only on Stone Mountain, but down in the valley too. And since then, since he's left Stone Mountain at age 18, and he's gone to Nashville, and he's become famous. But every band he's ever been in has been named Stone Mountain. And more than that, a lot of his songs are based in Stone Mountain. So that he may have become famous and his band may be famous, but he himself has not been back there. As a matter of fact, he is so certain that he never, ever wants to set foot on Stone Mountain again that he returns all mail that is sent to him in Nashville unread if it has a Stone Mountain return postage on it. And boy, does he have reasons to not want to go back there. And, you know, it's odd because he, I have to tell you, there is something a little bit autobiographical about this. Because when I first started writing my novels, so many of which are set in upstate New York, I was treated kind of like a favorite son. I mean, the people up there, they appreciated the fact that somebody was paying attention to their lives. Nobody else seemed in the United States seemed to care what was happening to them up there. But here was this Russo guy, and he'd moved away, but he was still writing about their lives as if their lives mattered. Boy, that came to a screeching halt mid-career when I wrote my memoir, which was called Elsewhere. And when that came out, where I called Gloversville for the first time, I'd been calling it Mohawk. I called it Thomaston. I called it North Bath. And everybody loved all of that. Even they recognized themselves. They recognized the town that I was from and that they were still living in. But then I went back and I wrote that memoir where I talked a little bit about the hometown, my hometown, Gloversville, and how they used to pour the tannery used to pour its toxic wastes into the stream that wound its way through the town. And I wrote about that and the fact that every exotic cancer known to man turned up there. And the closer you lived to the stream, the worse and more exotic form of that you got. And I also talked about how really dangerous the work was in the mills, because I'd done that at least one summer. I'm back in the work in the tanneries and the glove shops. It was really dangerous. My grandfather died of emphysema, breathing leather dust after working in the glove cutting industry for all of those years. But when I did that and wrote about Gloversville and called it Gloversville, the blowback was immediate. You know, and what people said was, you know, good for you, Russo. You made a really nice living for yourself, didn't you? You don't live here anymore. You're an elite now. You can live wherever you want, and you're living up in Maine now. But guess what? We're still here. And we're still poor. And the question that they were implying is the same one that Tyler gets asked, of course, almost immediately, which is, where's our cut? You know, and he goes back to Stone Mountain with a lot of people wanting to know how it was that he became so rich and famous and yet left them all behind as if they didn't matter even a little. And now here he is back. Where's our cut?
I marked a couple of quotes that I'll read to you right now, your words. You think to yourself that Stone Mountain is a place that doesn't yield many good outcomes. And then later, Tyler is speaking to his girlfriend and bandmate. This is probably going to sound crazy, but Stone Mountain is the kind of place you might escape from once, if you're lucky, but not twice. So why is Tyler going back to Stone Mountain? Set that up for us. Why is he going back to this place that he has escaped from and has not replied to since he left?
Well, strangely enough, he's going back there because the place, to everybody else but him, the place still doesn't matter a damn bit. And what's happened to set this up? A couple of things have happened in the time before all of this takes place, because Tyler is going to be taking his band on the road for the first time in a long time because they're coming in, it's right at the end of the pandemic. And there haven't been any live shows anywhere, not in Nashville, not anywhere in the United States. So his band, which is basically him and his singer-songwriter wife, Beth, they have pretty much been in lockdown pretty much this entire time. And Jason, who is the band's manager, does something without consulting Tyler. He thinks to himself, let's take the band out on the road. Let's get rid of some of the rust. Let's play some places where we can, shake off some of this rust and all of that. And he gets the idea without consulting Tyler to maybe do a benefit concert and make it look like a great act of generosity because one of Tyler's old friends, Doc, has some upcoming medical expenses. He is a paraplegic. He is paralyzed from the waist down, and we'll learn more about why when the book opens. But Jason decides that they'll do a benefit concert for Tyler's old friend. That way, how could he possibly object to that? Doing this benefit concert. And he makes it sound like an act of generosity, an act of goodwill. But in fact, the reason that Jason is doing this as his very first gig right out of the gate, the reason that they're really doing it is because Stone Mountain still doesn't matter. They can go up there, they can give the worst concert of their lives, the worst concert that this band has ever given, and nobody will know the difference because who the hell goes to Stone Mountain anyway? So that's the setup here. And the reason that Tyler is so terrified to go back has to do with how he left, which was in the cruelest way imaginable. He doesn't say goodbye to any of his best friends. The girlfriend, Freddie, that he was in love with and that his best friend was in love with, they're going to be there. All the friends of his youth are going to be there. And he does have that feeling that he's the luckiest guy on earth. He got to escape this place once, but you don't get to twice. And so when he goes back, he not only doesn't want to do this, he's scared to death. He really does believe that if he goes there again, he won't escape the second time. No way.
You know, this novel is told through a chorus of characters: Tyler, Beth, Deb, Kurt, and Everett. And I'm wondering, because, you know, there are other main characters, Doc, Freddie, Jr. How do you determine who gets a voice?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Because we are going to be changing points of view, that means that we're going to be getting certain information from various sources. And so one of the things the writer has to decide is, all right, who knows what and when does she know it? So you don't want to go into the voice of somebody who doesn't have information that ultimately the reader is going to want and to need. So you're only going to choose those voices that are going to add to the suspense, that can actually help make the plot go forward because of what they know. And Officer Deb is my favorite of those characters. First, because I think of her as kind of the moral center of the book. She is the one who really tries to make people, often men, she tries to make them look good, but she also has this really big heart. I mean, if she were going purely on her brain, what she's able to figure out just from paying attention and looking at the evidence and going by what that evidence suggests, we would have had a different book here. But she really loves her boss and wants to believe that Kurt, despite all available evidence, is a good man. And she believes it right to the end, and in a sense, she's right. He is a good man. He's doing bad things. And she doesn't want to admit it, even to herself. But she still believes and believes right straight through to the end that he is a good man. But also, she's the one that really tumbles finally in the end when we find out. We won't give too much away in the way of plot here, but when there's a point at which Tyler disappears. And Deb's the one who figures out where he is and puts her life on the line.
You know, there are a lot of serious societal issues present here: racism, abuse, opioid addiction. And many characters, not just Kurt, seem to be morally ambiguous. What did you want to explore with these issues in this novel?
Part of it was the times that we were living in during the pandemic, but also the time that we're living in now. I mean, Everett, whom we meet later in the novel, comes back at a time when he thinks it's safe to do so, but he was part of the insurrection, you know? And when he finally comes back to Stone Mountain, he's basically, for the last couple of years, he's been on the run. And so he comes back only when it's deemed safe. And of course, he's not a man who has an awful lot of moral scruples. He just wants to get back to living his kind of shady life existence that he had before. I loved the character of Deb that we've talked about for the various reasons that we've talked about, but then there's also her mother too, Connie. And one of the things that I was interested in, because it's true of a lot of the places in upstate New York that I continue to write about, you know, book after book after book, the landscape has changed up where I'm from. And as the place, my hometown, has grown poorer, poorer, and poorer, I still have friends and family there, and I go back from time to time. But it seems like every time I go back, the devastation of poverty and, yes, drugs has made matters that much worse. And so it just seemed incumbent that we look at some of those issues. I love the fact that Connie, Deb's mother, because of the fact that Stone Mountain has fallen on even harder times than when Tyler was growing up there, Connie, who is, Deb is black, but Connie, Consuela, is Latino. And because Stone Mountain has fallen on even harder times, that means that Connie can afford a place there, not one of the really nice places that are on the lake, but even someone as poor as Connie can afford to live in a place like this now, can afford a cottage there that she will be able to winterize so that she can live more or less comfortably through a long, cold winter in a place called Stone Mountain. And I'll say also that while I've been writing all these books set in upstate New York, they go back to the very early ones. The place that I'm writing about is, for the most part, pretty lily white, but it's changed a bit during those years. And people like Deb and Connie can exist in those places now. And if they're there, then it's incumbent upon a writer like me to acknowledge their existence. The first black character that I ever introduced into a book of mine was the character of Wussy in The Risk Pool, still one of my favorite novels and one of my favorite characters. But the reason that I dared to do that at that time was that Wussy was based on a character who was one of my father's best friends. And we worked road construction together. We did all manner of things together. The character that Wussy was based on did take me fishing, as he does to Ned in that novel. And so, because I knew this one black guy so well, I thought, all right, I'm going to take a chance here. It's just, he's not going to be the point of view character, but he is going to be a very important character in the novel. So there he was, and he was glorious. I loved him, and the book benefited from his being there. But like most writers, especially when you're a younger writer, you are a little bit concerned about writing about characters in a world that you don't know very well. You think to yourself, really, can I pull this off? And my first few novels were very much books about male behavior, male misbehavior. And that allowed me, for the most part, to reduce the participation of major characters who are women. Because frankly, I wasn't sure I could pull it off. I'm only this one person, and he happens to be male. And I was scared of writing a book that had a major female protagonist, say, and seeing that first book review come out and saying, well, one thing's pretty clear, and that is Richard Russo doesn't know a damn thing about women. But then, you know, a few years elapsed, and I woke up one day and looked around, and things had changed. My mom was still alive and still living with us. I was married to Barbara, my wife of now 50 some years. But I also had two growing daughters who were teenagers when I wrote Empire Falls. I mean, you go over a span of years to writing about male misbehavior because you're scared to write about women. And then one day you wake up and you look around and you think, all the important people in my life are women. And that provides you with a certain amount of chutzpah, I guess. I have four pretty good examples right here in front of me. And so you make that change. And this is what a writer's life is like. Your lived experience allows you to go a little bit farther than it would have 20 years ago. And also, not only allows you to do it, you now have the obligation to.
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Richard Russo, author of the novel Under the Falls. So we spoke about this novel being told through five character points of view, but I also wanted to ask about the writing of these chapters using a close third perspective. Can you talk about this and how point of view or perspective decisions can affect the way a story is told?
I'm looking back, kind of thinking about my novels over the years. I remember when I was teaching at a low residency writing program, Warren Wilson College was where I was teaching. And I remember giving a lecture there one year that was called In Defense of Omniscience. I really took to the omniscient point of view fairly early. And not all writers like it. If they experiment with it in the sense that they like the idea of being able to flit from one person's thoughts to another person's thoughts. You're seeing the world through one character, but then in the next chapter, you can see the world just as vividly through the eyes of another character. That allows you an enormous amount of freedom, right? What most beginning writers in particular don't realize about the omniscient point of view is that it allows you freedom to move within all of your characters, but it also allows you the freedom to create a voice that is outside of all of them. So in a sense, it's freedom from your characters. You can write a whole chapter of a novel or the beginning of a novel. You can write the first 10 pages of a novel before you go into any character's point of view. That's kind of what I mean by freedom from. And what that allows you to do is to create a voice of your own that is separate from them. That sense that the reader has of being spoken to by someone who is not any of the characters in the book. And that's what I love about omniscient point of view and why I have used it throughout so many of my novels and why I don't like first person. I've written in first person point of view. I have to admit that for the most part, I don't like it. You get trapped there, you know? I mean, well, you can switch. You can give a narrator two or three different first-person points of view, but that hasn't never really appealed to me either. So your question is spot on. Those kinds of point of view decisions that you make early on in the book, they determine, you know, so much of what follows. They're basic decisions, and boy, is it possible to screw up and realize that this was not a wise choice of point of view here, and start over again here, do something that makes sense. But that's hard to do when you're 300 pages into a book that you have been faithful. If you've been faithful to a mistake for 300 pages, it's really hard to change your mind.
In the acknowledgments of my advanced reader copy, you wrote that Under the Falls began as a TV pilot script that didn't make it past the WGA writer's strike. So it then became a novel. It's easy for me to imagine this as a film, but I'm sure a lot had to change to transform this into a novel. How did that shift affect your writing process?
Good question. I love writing screenplays. And yes, I did. Now, this began as a pilot with a couple of other local writers here, as a matter of fact. Ron Curry, who's getting a lot of well-deserved credit right now for his Babs Dion novels, is a good friend of mine here. And Josh Moore, his writing partner, and another writer, local writer here, Jules Selbo. I wrote the pilot, but then we thought if it gets up and running, we'll divide the story. In the pilot, it only went as far as Tyler's accident. The limo leaves the road. That's where the pilot finished. But now to go back and write it as a novel makes your job, first of all, much more difficult. I'll confess to you that I love writing screenplays because writing screenplays plays to my strengths. I don't have a very good eye. I learn from my characters by letting them talk to me. And in my first drafts, very often I'm just taking dictation on what they're saying. And after two or three pages of this, I'll have to stop myself and say, Rick, slow down, see something for God's sake, you know, just don't keep rattling this off. But that's how I learn about my characters. And that's really how I go about living my life too. I'm much more likely. My wife has a very good eye. When we go places, she always remembers the places that we've gone, and she can describe the room, describe the hotel, describe all of that. I haven't probably really even seen very much of it at all. I'm remembering what somebody said at breakfast that morning. So I just have this ear. And so writing screenplays is great because that's all screenplays are. It's just dialogue and putting your characters in motion and seeing what they do, seeing what they say. So it plays to all of my strengths as a writer. And all of the things that give me trouble, I can just dispense with because You don't spend a lot of time in a screenplay describing a house where the action takes place, because the house that where the action takes place is going to depend on which houses are available when it comes time to shoot the movie. So all of that is off the table. But now, so I go home, I've written this pilot for something called Under the Falls. I go home, the writer's strike, Hollywood is still screwed up even after the writer's strike. It's not going anywhere. I'm going to write it as a novel. Now what happens though is, before I was doing everything with a hammer and a bunch of nails and maybe a wrench, but now when I'm writing a novel, I open up my toolbox and I remember all the other tools that were in there. And even the tools that I'm not very good at sometimes, like seeing clearly, it's just wonderful to go back to be able to use the entire toolbox instead of only two or three. Even if they're the ones that you like the most, it's wonderful to go back and be in charge of the whole thing.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Under the Falls?
Well, what I hope that they will take away from Under the Falls is something that you don't get very often in a thriller. Plot-driven thrillers, and don't get me wrong, I love them, but what plot-driven thrillers elicit from the audience very often is a gasp. It's, oh my God, I didn't see that coming. And the tension rises with each surprise like that, each plot twist. The stakes get raised, and you do have that gasp after gasp until the suspense becomes almost unbearable, and finally there is a conclusion. And I love those. I love those kinds of thrillers. I think what I would want readers and hope readers enjoy reading as much as I enjoyed writing was the final scene of this thriller at a place where we've been before. We go to this place that's kind of a swimming hole that they build this dam. It dams up this small river and creates this big swimming place. And it's the first place that we go to because Tyler, when he's just a boy, goes under the falls and his best friend finds him there. His best friend, Kurt, has learned that Tyler, poor Tyler, has watched his father beat the crap out of his mother, and Tyler couldn't intervene. He's just a kid. And Kurt tells him that he's not alone, that they'll be together. So there we are under the falls. And we come back to that same campground at the end. And once again, it's Tyler, and he's got Kurt with him. They have a conversation at the end in this now kind of haunted place, because it's meant so much right from the beginning of the book. They have this kind of haunted conversation that the thing that I love about it most is it's just kind of heartbreaking. And that's what you don't expect most times from a thriller, is it? You don't expect to close the book and kind of dry your eyes. And as I was saying earlier, my editor's good advice about the kind of thriller that she wanted me to write, a kind of Richard Russo novelist thriller, that pays off dividends even at the end, where it's not the form of the thriller that's got me there at the end. It's this place and these two characters that I've grown to care about so much that I just want things to be right for them.
Well, the book is Under the Falls. Richard Russo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you for the interest in the novel and for the conversation and the good questions. It's been a joy.
Under the Falls by Richard Russo was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Luann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.